It is 6 o'clock. We have 25 members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors present. That is a quorum. I will call us to order and ask that we stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good evening and welcome to the July 9th La Crosse County Board of Supervisors planning meeting. We have a very full agenda this evening, starting with supervisor conference reports and announcements. Are there any? That'll keep us on track. Thank you. With the indulgence of the board, I would just share a quick story. If you can remember last Thursday, one of the many hot days here in La Crosse County, heat index somewhere in the, 105 range. Our public health department leadership received an email that from the Salvation Army that their air conditioning unit was not working, which affected the cooling station, which is a temporary spot for people to come in out of the heat, but also would have had also shut down the cooling for their shelter, which on that night had 71 residents. So 71 people were being housed at the Salvation Army shelter, and they were looking at not having air conditioning in that facility. Our leadership from the Public Health Department went to work along with help from our facility staff, folks over at the La Crosse Center, at a couple of local churches. There were lots of folks working on this. But what I wanted to share with you is that they identified very rapidly a cooling center, which was the campus ministry building at 4th and Pine, and Doug Mormon and Al Graywin from the Public Health Department took about 20 cots in Doug Mormon's Honda Civic. I'll let you go with that image as well, and took water and other supplies over to that cooling center, and it turns out that there was a mother there with a couple of small children. There was a Red Cross volunteer there to staff the cooling center. And then a couple of single gentlemen arrived also to the cooling center. And the Red Cross volunteer was a female. And so they try to staff for both genders if there are both genders represented in the clientele. And so Doug Mormon went back home and grabbed a pillow and a change of clothes and went back and spent the evening at the cooling center. And I just think it's a great example of public service and also the collective work that was done by facility staff and everyone in the public health department, and I'm sure lots of other agencies around that dealt with a very potentially dangerous situation and took care of the public health of La Crosse County. So I share that with you as a reminder of what good things are being done every day by La Crosse County staff. And with that, seeing no one having any other conference reports or announcements, we'll turn the meeting over to Administrator O'Malley.
As appropriate with one of our main agenda items, proclamation for July 2012 Nursing Home Month. Whereas La Crosse County residents or members of their family are provided affordable, quality nursing services in a family-like environment, including those whose care may be difficult or those without financial support, and where staff is committed to excellence in providing care and rehabilitation to all with respect for the dignity and rights of individuals, including those who have special physical, developmental, and mental health needs, and whereas La Crosse County operates two nursing homes, Hillview Health Care Center and Lakeview Health Center, now therefore be it resolved the La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of July is La Crosse County Nursing Home Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to ensuring quality care to our residents in need.
That's a proclamation moved by Supervisor Plesha, seconded by Supervisor Holtz. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That proclamation is approved unanimously.
Madam Chair, members of the board, the next item we have is a presentation by actually Clifton Larson Allen. They changed their name. Maybe they'll explain why they changed their name. But I'm turning this over to Renee Messing and Gary Engelson to provide the annual audit report.
And I also want to mention everybody should have received in your locker the 2011 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for the county. This is prepared by Sharon Davidson, Assistant Finance Director, Sean Hanlon, and Jonathan Edwards, our two internal auditors, and they do a lot of work in putting this report together. In addition to Renee here with Clifton Larson Allen is Deborah Welch. She's the senior manager with the firm who is in charge of all the field work, and Renee at the podium is a partner. And we distributed their report, which you received tonight. So, Renee.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you this evening. The PowerPoint that you have in your handout, as well as up on the screen, is really a very high-level summary of all of the information in the book that Gary talked about that the staff puts together. Let's see, who's got the clicker? Do I have it? Sorry.
Let's see, it should be.
Should have looked for that first.
There we go. Right there.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay. The financial report contains a number of components. The part of that report that's ours as your auditors is the independent auditor's report, and that report says that your financial statements are presented fairly in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. That's commonly referred to as a clean opinion, and that's what the board hires the auditors to determine, and that's what citizens and bondholders and other interested parties are looking for when they read that particular page of the audit report. The other components of the document include management discussion and analysis, the financial statements themselves along with the footnotes, and some required supplementary information that includes budgetary comparisons, as well as some statistical information in the back part of the report. When we come into your offices to perform the audit work, we look at the county's systems of internal control, your checks and balances, and your areas of significant risk. And as we look at those areas, we test transactions and account balances and reconciliations for the areas that are the most significant audit areas within the county. You can see the list of those up there, including cash and investments, receivables and revenue, capital assets, long-term debt, including OPEB liabilities and claims payable, and of course, fund balance and expenses. On page 4 of the handout is a summary of the general fund operations for 2011. And you'll see in that first column the actual results of operations were revenues greater than expenses by $550,000. And that gives you fund balance at the end of the year of $26.3 million. Now, that fund balance is in 5 new categories during this year. The county implemented a new accounting standard that requires some of your fund balance to be considered non-spendable, and that would be as it implies. It represents primarily receivables that are part of fund balance that aren't spendable. It includes items that are restricted. They're restricted by external sources, other funding sources. It includes committed balances that are committed by the actions of this board. And it includes assigned balances that are committed by actions of county management. And then finally, and probably most importantly, the unassigned balance. And you can see that unassigned balance is $14.1 million, and that represents about 45% of your annual budgeted expenditures of the general fund. And looking at how does that compare with the policy that you've set out, your policy indicates that fund balance should be somewhere between 40 and 50% of general fund expenditures. So you can see that you're very strongly in compliance with your policy. One of the things that I think is important is, as you look at that unassigned balance, is to look at how does that compare with other governments. You are in a very strong financial position. Most other governments, counties as well as large cities, target somewhere around 25% of their expenditures in fund balance and kind of struggle to meet that 25%. So you're very strong in terms of your fund balance position. And that may give you some opportunity to re-examine your policies, to look at your priorities in terms of capital needs or potential to do interfund loans with that fund balance to perhaps avoid external borrowing. But in short, your general fund is in very strong financial position. As we go through this, you'll see that the county has a number of funds, and those funds make your accounting system, of course, very complicated, but it's very typical of governmental units. The other governmental funds that you see here include the Human Services Fund that had $1.4 million of revenues greater than expenses for the year and has a balance of $7.4 million. And you can see that that Human Services Fund balance is about 25% of its expenditures on an annual basis, so very strong financial position for the Human Services Fund. The Debt Service Fund is the next column. You'll see there your revenues were $5 million compared to expenditures of $11.6 million. So you reduced that Debt Service Fund balance. That was by design. And that fund balance at the end of the year is $2.7 million. New to the category of major funds this year is your Business Fund. Your Business Fund accounts for primarily the loan activity that you have. And during 2011, you had a $4.5 million loan that increased substantially the size of this fund. And you can see that it had revenues less than expenses of $806,000 and has a very small fund balance of $299,000 at the end of the year. The final column that you see there are your non-major governmental funds, and there are about 12 of these funds. You can see the list at the bottom of the page identifies the more significant items that are included in those non-major funds. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is that your non-major funds had a reduction in fund balance of $1.4 million, and that's primarily the result of expenditure of the final funds for the law enforcement facility construction. So it used up those construction funds that were on hand. You can see that the jail assessment fund has $1.1 million of fund balance, and the old landfill has $1.2 million, and the health fund just over $1 million. And those are the most significant of those non-major funds. But each of those gets attention during the audit process, looking at the results of operations as well as the fund balances. A number of years ago, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board required the county and all governments to report its financial information in two different ways. The way that we just looked at it is called fund accounting, and that's how you manage the county's operations, and it's really the most significant part of your financial reporting process. But the other method is the full accrual method, and this accounts for all of your capital assets as well as all of your long-term liabilities. So you can see at the top of the page your fund balances are summarized, and they total $41.8 million. To that, we add your capital assets, and this is your land, buildings, and equipment net of accumulated depreciation. So it's at cost minus accumulated depreciation. We add in some receivables that aren't recognized in the fund basis. We add in your internal service funds of $76 million, and we deduct your long-term obligations, and your long-term obligations are about $50 million at the end of 2011. On that basis of accounting, you have net assets on a business-type reporting of $132 million. Now, I just wanted to mention on those long-term obligations, that's about $44 million of general obligation debt and about $6 million of other post-employment benefit obligations, so benefits that will be paid to retirees at a point in the future. Now, you also have some business-type reporting. These are called enterprise funds. Your two major enterprise funds are your health care facility at Hillview, as well as the solid waste operation. There you'll see that Hillview had a change in net assets of $238,000. and it has net assets at the end of the year of $5.9 million. Equally important to remember is that those net assets at Hillview include its land, buildings, and equipment. So of that $5.9 million, almost $2 million is investment in the capital assets, and the balance really represents the available funding for the organization. The solid waste operation, you can see, had net income for the year, or change in assets, of $921,000, and it has $5.9 million of net assets at the end of the year. Of that, $2 million is invested in capital assets, and the balance is available for continuing operations as well as some restricted funds for solid waste operations. The non-major funds, again, are relatively numerous. I've listed toward the bottom of the page there the more significant ones, including the Carroll Heights Apartments, Hillview Terrace, which is a new fund for you in 2011, and the Lakeview Nursing Home Facility. Now, that facility fund for Lakeview just accounts for the rental of that facility to Mississippi Valley Health Services. So the county accounts for the building and the depreciation of the building and charges rent to Mississippi Valley for financing that depreciation cost. In total, those funds have net assets of $6.7 million. Of that, $4.6 million is in capital assets. Next, you have two different kinds of internal service funds. The first one of those is your highway operation. You can see there the highway is about $10.9 million of revenues compared to $9.8 million of expenses. It had an increase in its net assets of $1.1 million for the year. And you can see that a significant part of the net assets of the highway department represent investment in capital assets, about $62 million of the $68 million of net assets. The self-insurance funds account for the self-insurance activity of the county, including liability insurance as well as employee health and dental insurance. You can see there your self-insurance funds have about $18 million of activity during the year for those insurance benefits. You had an increase in those net assets of $783,000, and you have $11.1 million of net assets at the end of the year. Those assets are really held in reserve as essentially a contingency reserve for catastrophic losses related to the liabilities that you have in those particular self-insured activities. Well, those are all of the numbers part of the financial statements. When you look at the financial statements themselves, we have about 10 pages of financial information followed by about 45 pages of footnote disclosures. The most significant of those disclosures are your accounting policies, your deposits and investments, your capital assets, long-term obligations, your other post-employment benefits, and then your risk management activities. They are quite lengthy, and it's tough to read them, but I think if you have opportunity to at least scan through them, there's some very good information in there. Now, in addition to the audit report itself, we do issue a document called an audit communication letter. And that letter talks about a number of things. One of those is the auditor's responsibility under auditing standards. And as I mentioned at the start of my comments, when we look at your systems of internal control and test your systems and test your account balances and reconciliations, that's our responsibility to test your systems. It's really your management's responsibility to execute those internal controls and to maintain those internal controls, as well as having responsibility for the financial statements. The letter talks about qualitative aspects of accounting policies and disclosures, and it talks about a number of significant estimates, including the other post-employment benefits estimate and the post-closure costs in the landfill operations, and your claims payable in your self-insurance fund. So those are the most significant estimates in the financial reporting process, and the staff does a very good job of documenting and estimating those particular liabilities. We're required to identify if there were any adjustments posted as part of the audit process. During the 2011 audit, we did identify a few adjustments. Those adjustments were specifically related to the year-end accrual process, recording claims payable, and some recording of receivables at the end of the year related to some grant funds. What I would say is that while there were adjustments during the year, the information that is recorded on a routine basis throughout the year is very accurate, didn't require any adjustments. Those adjustments really are all year-end type transactions where additional information became available subsequent to the start of the audit process. There was one adjustment that wasn't posted to your books and records. It's very minor, and it really has to do with the accounting for the Highway Department transportation cost pool, where you follow the requirements of the Department of Transportation. Those requirements are not in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, but it's only about $29,000, so we don't have any concerns about that item at all. The other matters that are disclosed in that letter are really very positive things. They talk about management's representations, that there were no disagreements with management in the audit process, and no difficulties in performing the audit. And I do want to just commend Gary and Sharon and really the entire finance department staff. They do an excellent job of preparing information throughout the year, preparing the budget, as well as preparing this document that is subject to audit. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Any questions from Supervisor? Supervisor Veenstra.
I'm sort of curious. I'm a lawyer, so I've done a little bit of work with insurance companies about reserves for claims that may be payable in the future. Does the county use a reserve process, or how do they estimate potential claims that they think might be out there?
Well, it depends on which kind of self-insurance activity, but for example, for the health insurance claims, the third-party processor provides a lag report as well as an actuarial estimate of the liability. For the liability insurance, the third-party administrator of that insurance provides some estimates, and then we also look at all of the activity and discuss any claims that are known with corp counsel.
Any other questions? Supervisor Geary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 4, I was looking at that variance. Was that supposed to be over or under? On page 4 in the right-hand column, that $3,997,000.
It's an over variance, and what it is it's over on revenues and it's under on expenses. So overall, it's a positive variance. So what that means is that your budget thought that you would use up, if you spent everything that you had budgeted, you would have used up $3.4 million of fund balance. Instead, you didn't spend all of that money, and it was really added back into fund balance, or not used from fund balance. And a large part of that variance is contingency funds that weren't needed, as well as capital outlay that was carried over into 2012.
Okay, by expenditures, you mean they got transferred back into
fund balance.
It really wasn't an expenditure. It was a transfer from expenditure.
Right, back into fund balance.
Supervisor Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page five, under non-major funds, what's that land record and special jail assessments?
The land record assessment fund accounts for the portion of land transfer fees that are held in a special fund that then are used only for the purposes of improving the record keeping for the land records department.
What about the jail then? What's that?
The jail assessment is a portion of the fines that are collected are set aside in this fund and used for public safety purposes.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? It's your lucky night, Renee. only three questioners tonight. Did you want to comment at all about the name change? I think Steve referenced that, and then we didn't loop back on that.
On January 2nd of 2012, Clifton Gunderson merged with a firm called Larson Allen. Each of the firms was a firm with 50 years of history. We came together to form Clifton Larson Allen. It is quite a mouthful to say, but Clifton Larson Allen is the eighth largest CPA firm in the country. The specialization of the firm is really in two areas. Primarily, we serve the public sector, serving governments and nonprofit organizations. That's about 60% of our firm's revenue and focus. The other part of the firm serves private or closely held businesses. So we don't serve SEC companies or publicly traded companies. We really focus on serving the communities that we live and work in, as well as serving small businesses in those communities.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you for the report, and I know I will work on retraining myself to stop saying Clifton Gunderson, but it might take a little while because you've been working with us for a number of years.
And it is hard to make that change.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Deb, as well, and to the finance staff of La Crosse County.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item I have is something we get to do annually. This is the sixth year in a row that we've been able to recognize our finance staff. You've just heard a report reviewing the 2011 financial statement. Each year we submit the comprehensive annual financial report for analysis and recognition by the Government Finance Officers Association of America. And this year, again, for 2010, I'm proud to say that our finance department received the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting for the annual statement for 2010. And I want to just say a couple words about that. The Certificate of Achievement is the highest form of recognition in the area of governmental accounting and financial reporting, and its attainment represents a significant accomplishment by government and its management. That represents you and all of our staff, but the finance department is the one responsible for putting it together and doing all of the work. This is the sixth year in a row that we've received the highest standard that you can. Less than, I believe it's around 6% of governments in the nation, local governments, receive this award, and we've met this standard, and it's a peer review process by independent people that have nothing to do with our operation, actually reviewing the document that's submitted, making comments for improvement, and giving feedback, and we've met that standard for the sixth year in a row through 2010. And the people that deserve the recognition, of course, are Gary, Sharon, Sean, and Jonathan. And I don't know if Gary wants to say a few more words, but I'm just so impressed by the standards of excellence that they meet on our behalf.
I just want to say the credit really does go to Sharon and Jonathan and Sean and a few others in our department. It again, takes an awful lot of work. After each time that we get the certificate, there are sometimes little items that the peer review comes up with that need to be corrected for the following year, so that, you know, that's not in the process. And again, it's really the hard work and the effort of those three, so they deserve the award. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Madam Chair, members of the board, the other items that we have then are actually reports by staff on a number of items that are that you've requested and or are part of our budget process. So the next item is actually Brian Fukuda, while he's getting set up here, as well as I believe he's got a couple of citizen speakers to help. This was requested by the board, and it was very timely to bring to you, is the overall context of some of the things that Brian Fukuda, as our community development specialist, is working on, including challenging trends within La Crosse, discussion about the La Crosse Promise, and the Joint Housing Task Force. So it's going to be one report with a number of inputs for that. And Brian, I think I'll just turn it over to you rather than give more of an introduction.
Great. Thank you. I've got some slides. Mr. O'Malley makes sure that I do PowerPoints every time I come before you. So.
It's
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me to talk to you a little bit about some of the great collaborative projects that we're able to work on as your community development staff. And as Mr. O'Malley mentioned, we want to talk a little bit about some work that's all kind of tied together, but it starts with a challenging trends report that we did, kind of rolls into some of the work that we've done with assisting the La Crosse Promise in getting started up, and then also the Joint Housing Task Force that was the task force that was a city-county of La Crosse joint task force. So I'll get into it, maybe. So the Challenging Trends Report was kind of led by the County Economic Development Work Group to look at some of the challenging trends that we're facing. This is a report that was completed in August of 2009. We also worked together with the City of La Crosse Planning Department on this report, but it looked at a lot of the different trends, and this is out on the web. I won't go into a lot of this. If you're interested, if you haven't read it, I'd encourage you to do that. But again, we looked at populations, school enrollments. We did a GIS analysis of vacant residential lots. We looked at tax rate disparities across our municipalities throughout the county. Looked at concentrations of poverty, neighborhood deterioration and crime, and investment in public infrastructure. So we looked at a lot of those trends, kind of how they interact with each other, and in how some of those trends kind of create some cyclical effect with other ones. So some of the alarming trends that we looked at in this report were we identified that there was almost $120 million in school referendums that were passed in a 15-year period, while the total enrollment grew by only 5.9% over that 15-year period. So that's pretty low growth for enrollment or for spending $120 million on building new schools and new school infrastructure. Also in 2007, we looked at the County Road Study. That identified over $24 million in unfunded road needs. And those are just the needs to address congestion and safety concerns. This has continued to increase as we've continued to look at it since this 2007 report was done. There was almost 2,500 vacant buildable residential lots in La Crosse County. Like I said, this was a GIS analysis. These aren't lots that are on the market, but they're lots that are buildable without any improvements on them. 55% of those were outside of our incorporated areas. Again, some of these just kind of look at some of the effects of sprawling development patterns and those sorts of things. So we looked at one of the leading indicators of poverty is the free and reduced priced meals that are available in our school districts. Some schools, the La Crosse School District as a whole, at this point that the report was done, was at 40.8% of students were eligible for free and reduced price lunches. And then there were some schools that were as high as 77% and 67%. So that indicates a pretty high concentration of poverty around those schools and in those districts. There was also a significant increase in arrests for nonviolent crimes, things like vandalism, fraud, stolen property, OWIs, those sorts of things. By the City of La Crosse Police Department. It went from about 2,300 per year in 1985 up to 7,500 a year in 2006. So, you know, just some trends that we started to think were identifying some of our challenges as a community. As we look at these trends, we also like to try to keep our eye out for innovative new programs that things that might help us to address some of these trends. So, We happen to take note of Kalamazoo, Michigan, a community that was at one point facing a lot of the same issues that we're facing with sprawling development patterns, increasing crime, increasing concentrations of poverty, tax rate disparities, those sorts of things. They found the power of a promise. There's actually a book entitled The Power of a Promise. I'd encourage you to read it. If you don't, I'm happy to talk to you about it. What they did was they implemented a place-based universal scholarship program. They were lucky enough to have some very generous, very wealthy donors in their community that decided that they would make a promise to every student in their school district. And the promise was that if they graduated from high school and they could get into a higher educational institution in the state of Michigan, that they would pay their tuition. So this promise was given to the community. The donors stepped up, and they started to see some pretty eye-opening results from this. I categorized the results into inspiring dreams in our children. Their school enrollment went up about 10% in the first year. That led to new sources of revenues for the school district that allowed them to operate more efficiently. And they saw in 2004-05 school year, they had 265 students drop out of their high schools. In 2005, in the 2005-06 school year, which was when the promise was announced, or just after the promise was announced, they only had 21 students drop out. Parents, just kind of anecdotally, we've talked with their school superintendent at that time, and they saw parents get more engaged in the schools. They saw parents that they'd never seen before coming to PTA meetings and suddenly realizing that their kids had potential, and they wanted to make sure that all of their kids were prepared to take advantage of the promise that was out there for them. They also realized a lot of results that started to transform their community. They first saw this as a promise for kids. They ended up seeing it as an economic development strategy, as a promise to their community that would actually start to transform their community. Property sales went up 6% and values up 7% in that first year. They saw a number of companies that started to come in and locate there and grow there. The most notable one is Kaiser Aluminum Corporation that built an $80 million research and development facility actually just outside of Kalamazoo in one of their suburban communities. But they actually cited, as they made their announcement that they were coming to Kalamazoo, that the biggest reason that they were coming to Kalamazoo was because of the community's commitment to building an educated workforce that's going to be able to fill their jobs that they're creating in that community. And they also saw volunteerism increase across the community. They saw people calling the schools and calling the city and calling the Promise organization and saying, how can I help? This is so cool. How can I get involved? Can I start a mentorship program? How can I get engaged in this process? So it was just a really neat community building promise. So we took note of that, and we started studying it. The City, County, and School District of La Crosse have a history of collaboration called the Community Collaboration, where the mayor, the county board chair, and the superintendent of schools get together on a regular basis and talk about, we serve the same population, the same taxpayers, how can we better work together to serve those taxpayers. So we started talking a little bit about the Kalamazoo Promise in those meetings. Talked about the power of tying education and economic development together in our community. We started having some quiet discussions with some of our business leaders in our community, and that led to the funding of a feasibility study. We then hired W.E. Upjohn Institute to look at our community and see how a promise program could potentially work in our community and how we could structure it and what the results might be if we were to implement a similar program. The W.E. Upjohn Institute came back and said, because other communities are looking at this, we're starting to learn a lot from some of these other communities, they recommended a three-component program. They thought, let's start with future centers, and you'll hear a little bit more about that concept later, which is really geared towards preparing students to succeed in higher education and in careers after that. The scholarship component, which is really the financial incentive, if you will, to draw people into the community, and then housing and economic development programs to really make sure that our community is prepared to take advantage of that incentive, would that incentive present itself, and the demand in our real estate markets present itself. So we asked the question, well, who benefits from the promise? Who would benefit from this? And really the answer, you know, students, they'll be better prepared to succeed in higher education and in careers after that. The community, you know, higher demand for real estate, that's a good thing. the region, more efficient development patterns, businesses. We build a more educated workforce and a stronger tax base. So this is a billboard that's actually in the city of Kalamazoo. Sorry to use a billboard, but it says who benefits from the promise, and there's, you know, hands of all different sizes and colors, and really the message is that everyone benefits from this. So we started to look at a proposal. In August 2009, the County Collaboration Conference presented the Challenging Trends Report, and then looked at a variety of solutions, including a place-based scholarship program. In November of 2009, a community discussion started on the promise. The La Crosse Community Foundation got together with Logistics Health and organized a meeting to start, and asked us to come and talk to some of our business leaders and community leaders about this program in Kalamazoo, and started to engage them in the process. We asked for interest in working on this proposal, and in February of 2010, an interim board of directors for the La Crosse Promise Initiative started. This interim board, the members of the interim board are listed on the left there, representing a large mix of business leaders across the community, some of our largest employers and those folks coming to the table to talk about this proposal. They started to develop a proposal and a plan to really do some private fundraising. Again, this isn't a public incentive. This isn't something that we would anticipate using tax dollars for. This is a privately funded proposal being talked about by businesses, but being assisted by government and the school district. They developed branding and marketing materials. They met with potential donors and gathered feedback on this proposal. They started educating the community on the potential for this proposal, and really worked to strengthen community collaboration and raise awareness of a lot of these issues, a lot of the issues that are listed in the Challenging Trends Report, and starting to get that word out there and educate the community on these issues and why they're of concern. Fast forward after a couple years of work of that interim board, and now the La Crosse Promise Incorporated has been formed, in the process of filing for 501c3 status. This is the new board of directors. It's in the process of being populated. You'll see some familiar names on that. There was some carryover from the interim board. You'll also see that they've really tried to engage the city, county, and school district and include them on this board of directors. So that's the board. And I've actually asked our superintendent of schools, Randy Nelson, to join us today and talk a little bit about where the promise, the La Crosse Promise Incorporated, is going, and share with you a little bit of the good news of the initial funding and that sort of thing. So with that, I'll welcome Randy.
Thank you. It's great to be here. First time coming to the county board meeting. This is, Jerry told me this is a little bit like a school board meeting on steroids. I don't know if that's a true accurate depiction, but it's a good group. I can sure tell that. Well, I'm real excited to just bring you up to speed on what's been going on, kind of boots on the ground kind of a report, because we're real excited that in the fall we are going to be doing what's called phase one of this program called Future Centers. And we're ready to go. The funding is there, the staffing is there, and not only are those pieces there, but we're also providing the space so that we can really begin this particular project and get things rolling. A little bit more about the two pieces. There really is two parts to this. There's the Future Centers part, and there's also work to be done yet to design an effective scholarship program. And I think Jerry shared with me, I saw him just maybe earlier this morning, and he said that maybe a couple of years ago he was here to talk a little bit about promise programs, etc. So this may not be completely new to some of you. This scholarship program piece is probably what Jerry talked about most, the Kalamazoo big splash thing that goes on. But what we've decided to do, the focus of our committee at this particular point, our board at this point, has been to focus first on the Future Centers. Because what the folks at Kalamazoo told us was, we had this wonderful wonderful donation of millions of dollars to provide scholarships for our students. And so we started providing scholarships. And what we realized real quickly was that, some of our students weren't really ready for this. They weren't ready to go. And so they retroactively put in what are called some sort of a Future Centers program, which really is additional assistance, especially in their high schools, but could also be in middle schools and elementaries, to support students as they work to consider careers and moving forward with careers that would require post-secondary education. So a little bit more about the purpose of the Future Centers. What we're really looking at is creating an opportunity to really help our students really plan for a productive life after high school. You know, someone would say, well, isn't that really the job of our school counselors? And I'll tell you, the role of a school counselor has evolved a lot over the last 30 years. And I think if you ask our school counselors a lot what they really like doing, they say, I really like counseling children. I like to work with them. I'll work on their goals and their aspirations and help them get there. But more often than not today, our school counselors spend a lot of their time solving problems for kids that are not necessarily career-related and not necessarily post-secondary-related. Sometimes they're really supporting principals with issues that might have to do with social and emotional challenges that students are having. It takes up a lot of their time. And so what we find is that sometimes the very things that they really wanted to do when they thought about counseling sometimes compromised by the work that they have to do in supporting students, even with more important things than that. And so we really are looking at the Future Centers as a means to helping students get a picture of what that productive life after high school might look like for them. We also know that we need to collect data. There's a lot of data that needs to be collected yet about that would help us better understand what we need in terms of scholarships. You know, our high school graduates receive hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarships every year. This district does an outstanding job of supporting its children, supporting its students, providing scholarships, whether they're local scholarships or scholarships that are on the national scene. But we also know that there are millions and millions and millions of dollars in scholarships that go unaccounted for across the nation. And so one of the things we want to get a better idea for is how do we leverage those better so that we get an even a better picture of what our students need as they move on. So what we're doing is we are in the process of hiring Future Center advisors. Brian talked about the fundraising that has taken place up to this point. We have raised enough money to commit to Future Center advisors for 3 years in our schools. The Future Center advisor is something akin to a counselor, but the Future Center advisor is not employed by the School District of La Crosse. I really wish that we were in a mode to be hiring new people, but the fact of the matter is we've reduced our staff by about 25% over the last 10 years due to declining enrollments and budget challenges. And so we're not in a position to add people to do these. And so the generosity of several people, and I think the great thinking of people out in front of this has been, let's establish Future Center advisors that would exist in our high schools for the sole purpose of supporting our students in this way. And so they really are working to help our families identify achievable path to a profitable career. And I have to say that we're not talking about making sure all kids go to a four-year college. I don't think that's the right thing to do. What we're really talking about is what's your plan after high school? What we do know is that perhaps not every student will go to a four-year college, but we also think very strongly that virtually every student needs to have some plan for post-secondary schooling after high school. The end is not graduation. That's when things really start, and that's what we want to try to communicate to students. And so we talk about programs not being four-year college. It could be a welding program at TC, for instance. It could be an 8-week certificated program someplace, some way to help students get there. So exploring various higher educational opportunities, completing school applications. You know, one of the things, I don't know how many people in here have had fun filling out the FAFSA. How many people have done that before? That is not fun. That is not fun. I just got done with that thing about 2 months ago. Not a fun thing to do. And I have to tell you that for many of our students who either don't have access or somehow are in a generational thing where post-secondary is not what we do in our family, or my parents have just said it's not going to be possible, I can never afford it, etc. Just filling out the FAFSA is a huge, huge challenge for folks. And so part of it is, for the Future Center advisors, we want everyone to fill out the FAFSA. One of the things we did in the School District of La Crosse in the last couple of years is we're having more and more students, actually all of our students, take what's called the Explore test. It's an eighth grade test that all of our kids take now. And in that eighth grade test, it does two things. It does a career interest survey, and so it helps them identify some particular areas in these 16 career emphases. But it also provides for them a projected ACT score. And then they do the same thing at grade 10. They take it again. They see if some of their ideas and some of their skills have changed, but also gives them a projected ACT score. And our goal, as we continue on with our Future Center advisors, is that all of our students take the ACT and that they're prepared to move on into whatever that they want to do in post-secondary. Scholarship applications, another challenge. Other paperwork. So many times the paperwork really is what gets in the way. But I have to tell you, sometimes what really gets in the way is hope. Because, as Brian shared with you, the data from the School District of La Crosse, 40.8% students on free and reduced lunch. Right now that's at 48%, and I believe that in September, when we take our census on the third Friday of the school year, we'll eclipse the 50% mark. I think that's where we're going to be. It'll be pretty darn close if we're not quite there. And so that's a trend that we have seen over and over again. It reflects what's been happening in our community, what's been happening in our region as well to some extent. So our Future Center advisors will work with the schools and other institutions to change the culture. We want all of our students to be thinking that graduation is not the end, but it's the beginning of something for me to move forward. So the kids are thinking about higher education. They're thinking about it early. And then that we give kids the resources they need to be successful early on, early in their school age. And then finally, that's phase one. A little bit more about that, maybe. So beginning in the fall, we will have a full-time Future Center advisor who will be stationed at Central High School. And we'll also have a full-time Future Center advisor who will be stationed at Logan High School. And that'll be at no cost to the district because the staffing is being done and paid for by private funds that have been raised. And we know we have a three-year commitment to be able to fund the program for at least 3 years. That'll help us get our data together, our metrics together, so that we can move things forward. It's a good start for us. But it also ensures that we're moving things, and it's a really good example of getting our feet in the ground and getting things moving forward. We're also supporting, by the way, with those Future Center advisors, we're supporting students who are in our private schools as well. And so the Future Center advisors will be working with students from Aquinas. They'll also be working with students from Luther High School. It's important for all of our students who are in the School District of La Crosse to be able to have those kinds of supports. So that's a quick overview of the Future Centers and what our Future Center advisors are doing. We're real excited. As you see, Jerry Kember is our executive director of our Future Centers. We've hired the two Future Center advisors and the secretary who will be supporting them. They have yet to get together for the first time in a room, but we're excited for that to happen because we've got some very, very outstanding individuals who are going to be supporting our kids and our staff and our families as they really work to look at post-secondary. Then, the scholarship program, and that's probably the biggie. That's what most of these programs get earmarked for. It's that notion of being able to provide scholarships for students when they do decide what their post-secondary avenue is going to be. But we just really feel that this should be our second step on this because we've been getting feedback from community leaders, et cetera, that would suggest that let's get some success here at the Future Centers. Let's set up the conditions for success so that a scholarship program can logically follow from that. And so we need to better understand the scholarships and how they work. We need to craft a program that we know is really going to address and incentivize the challenging trends that Brian has presented and know that you've seen before. How do we create this so that it really does spur the economic base here in our community so that we can make a solid difference? We really, in the big picture, want to build our community. When you think about it, one of the unique things about La Crosse, among many things, from an education perspective, think of the post-secondary opportunities we have. Solid. We've got a solid K-12 system, and we think there's no reason that in our state we can't be known as the education community. And that's one of our brandings that we get, and it's one of the things that brings people back to our community and helps us fill up our schools again and maybe kind of stop the trend of decreasing enrollment for us. And so we really think that also, in turn, it would have a substantial impact on the housing market. I probably took up more time than you wanted, Brian, but that's what I have, and I'll stick around for questions when we're done. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Randy. So at the last point there was that this would work to change the dynamics of our housing market and really change the dynamics of our real estate market. So as as we were talking about this, and as the folks from the Upjohn Institute said, that needed to be that three-legged stool approach. We've heard about the scholarship and the future centers. The other part of that is housing and economic development. Well, as we talked about it, we thought we really needed the government to take the city and county to take a little more active role in addressing that aspect of it. But we really needed the input and the cooperation of the industry professionals that work in our market every day, in our housing market. So that was the formation of the Joint Housing Task Force. So the Joint Housing Task Force started. We really started this as kind of a subcommittee of the La Crosse Promise discussion, where we started talking with some of our industry professionals. We started calling meetings and asking them to help us understand how this would work in our market. And in May of 2011, the County Board passed a resolution. The City Council passed a resolution creating the Joint Housing Task Force. The task of the task force is to prepare a report that identifies cost-effective options for reversing the current housing trends in the city, to provide elected officials with input from industry professionals, to raise community awareness of these housing issues, and to really build a solid foundation for a public-private partnership that it's going to work to address those challenging trends. So the Housing Task Force began its work in June of 2011. The Housing Task Force members are listed on the left-hand side there. They started meeting semi-monthly. They worked in a lot of opportunity for public comment and input. It was on both the front and the back of every agenda, encouraging folks to show up and voice their concerns and input. In January of 2012, the report was completed. It was a six-month process for this task force to complete its work. That report included a situation analysis. It includes a lot of those challenging trends, those sorts of things, but also some of our community building blocks and those things that we can really build off of to create success, the foundation and objectives. And then we talked about a wide variety of policy and strategy options, and then the task force made some recommendations for how we can move forward. In March of 2012, the City Council passed the resolution adopting the findings of this report, and we're going to be asking the County Board to do the same. I've asked Rick Staff, who is the President and Legal Counsel of Gerard Heschler Realtors. He's also served as the Chair of this Housing Task Force. So I've asked Rick to come and talk with you a little bit about the process of the task force, the recommendations that they made, and then kind of where we go from here. So I'll ask Rick to come up and thank him for being here.
Brian promised that I wouldn't have to move any screens, so everything I need to talk about is right there. Should mention very briefly that so much of this began with the county staff. You know, certainly the city and other groups participated heavily, but with Steve and Brian and Carl and Charlie, very, very hands-on, Tara and Tina and Jill, very, very active. I mean, it really, the county played a major role in what I think was a very interesting process. I spent 20 years in the housing industry in Madison, and I don't think I've seen any committee be as productive and come up with as creative an approach to a problem as this one. I think part of it was the joint work of the city, the county, and the private sector. And at the end of the day, when you look, and I know you've all read this to the point where I'd just be wasting all of our time to go over the details, but when you look at the tools that we identified, there's nothing remarkable there. The number one suggestion, enforce the current law. TIF work, you know, the number of things are strongly recommended, but when you look at the list, no wheels were reinvented. But at the end of the day, I think the strongest recommendation that we made relates to the bottom bullet point and is based on our examination of where people have been successful. The Marquette University campus area, where unfortunately things got to a point where they had to step in. And this was soon after the Jeffrey Dahmer incident in the city. I went to school there just before there were murders on campus, and they got to that tipping point, and we talked a lot about what are these tipping points that are going to move us forward. They had to move forward, and they did a remarkable job. The Phillips neighborhood in Minneapolis. What distinguished those successful efforts was that the private sector and the public sector worked hand in hand, And we saw the beginnings of that with this task force, and I think all of our challenges, hopefully as you approve this report and going forward, is to bring back that energy and make sure that we do engage the private sector with the county, with the city, take this report and begin to implement it one step at a time. Now, there's another process that's going to start very soon with some planning work being done in the Gunderson campus and the Paul Hood Hamilton area, which is absolutely necessary. This wasn't a report limited just to Paul Hood Hamilton, but no one had any doubt in our reporting that that was where we had to start. That was the point where the need was the greatest. And so that process is moving forward. But again, I always come back to the last bullet, and I'll end with that and be happy to answer any questions. My biggest challenge is, what's the next step? Not what did we do, but what do we do next to bring that coalition together and get all those people engaged? Because I took it upon myself, I think really the only thing I offered to this group was going out and meeting as many of the stakeholders as I could. And every meeting ended exactly the same way. Every one of those people said, tell us what we need to do. And that's what we haven't done yet. That's what we need to do going forward. And I think we'll see remarkable success when we tell them what they need to do and they step up and do it. So that's the next step. But everybody did a great job up to this point. Look at that report. You'll see some very practical, you know, well-tested tools that all of which will work to some extent, and we just have to move it in that direction.
Thanks, Rick. So on that note, next steps. With all of this work, I guess the next steps would be that we would like to ask the county board to accept the findings of the Housing Task Force report. That report, as I mentioned, is out there on the internet. We can certainly get you hard copies if you'd like. It's actually in a couple of different places. If you go under the county committees, the Housing Task Force is there. There's a number of materials that we used throughout the task force. You can review those, the minutes, and then the final report. It's also, I believe, on the UW Extension website under in Carl Green's area. There's a lot of this background housing trends report, the challenging trends report, in some of this data. So we'd like to ask you to do that. We'll probably be bringing that back in a resolution format, either at your meeting this month or next month. We want to, as your staff, continue to keep an eye on these trends and report back to you. We'll hope to update that challenging trends report periodically. We want to continue to support the work of the La Crosse Promise Incorporated, assisting with research and coordination of their efforts. We'd also support the Neighborhood Revitalization Commission of the City of La Crosse. That's kind of the entity that kind of took that report and is following up on a lot of that work. They did some tremendous work with getting people out into those neighborhoods. Supervisor Landre, I know, serves on that Neighborhood Revitalization Commission. There's also some other overlap. We want to stay engaged as county staff in that process as well. And then participate in community discussions regarding the development of a community development corporation. There's been a number of entities that have started some community discussions about that. There's a meeting coming up actually later this week on I think it's on Friday, I'll be presenting some data on a community development corporation and how community development corporations can work to do some of the work that the Housing Task Force report talked about. So we want to certainly stay engaged in that process and assist the community in those discussions and coming up with what the most efficient way to move forward to address the trends would be. I wanted to end with why this work is important. The trends indicate regional inefficiencies that start with the core in the city of La Crosse. But no mistake, these are regional inefficiencies. These are things that are countywide, are region-wide. They don't stop at boundaries. These trends will only be reversed through effective public-private partnership. I think Rick said it well, that we need that public-private cooperation to move forward and address these trends. This ties in with all of the other work that the County Economic Development Work Group is doing. with creating a community that is attractive for development, marketing vacant properties in our community, and trying to control taxes, helping local government to realize increased efficiencies, and encouraging growth amongst our real estate tax base in the county. So that's all I have. With that, we can certainly take questions of any of us.
Thank you, Brian. I also want to thank Randy Nelson and Rick Staff for sticking around, for being here and presenting. And feel free, supervisors, to direct questions at any of the folks who presented, starting with Supervisor Doyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question with regard to the La Crosse Promise, and whoever wants to address it is fine with me. Over half of the county board at this point comes from outside the city of La Crosse, and some may be thinking, well, you know, I don't represent the city of La Crosse. This doesn't do anything for my school district. Maybe it even hurts my school district. Can you explain why the La Crosse Promise should be of interest to people outside the city of La Crosse and what benefit might accrue to school districts or the county as a whole?
Sure. Yeah, I should have addressed that, so thank you for the question. I think as this slide indicates, and as I tried to make the point, was these are regional inefficiencies. The trends indicated are sprawling development patterns. I guess one of the best indicators that I can say is I think some of our other school districts outside of the La Crosse School District are increasing such tremendous growth that they're struggling to deal with that growth, and that is an inefficiency. And as those school districts are growing, the La Crosse School District is closing schools, and we're needing to build new schools out in those districts. And you know, we talk about the West Salem TIF district. The school district actually voted against that TIF district primarily because they were afraid of growth, that growth would push them over the point that they would have to build a new school. No school district wants to go through a referendum to build a new school. It's not a fun process. So that's one of the things. I think I'd encourage you to read the Challenging Trends report and look at some of the regional inefficiencies. This is about building a regional economy. The Kaiser Aluminum Corporation example of building an $80 million facility not in the city of Kalamazoo, where it's not within the Promise District, but they were attracted to building an educated workforce within that entire community. So this is a regional project.
I'd like to also add that particularly for supervisors that don't live within the school district of La Crosse, what's happening, and you've seen the trend over time, is that the tax base supported by the city of La Crosse is declining. The cost of county services is being shifted outside the city of La Crosse. Declining or stagnant tax bases in the city of La Crosse, because so much of the commercial development is in TIF, most of the residential value are stagnant or low, we are shifting the cost of community services from La Crosse, the city, to the outer lying areas. So concentrations of poverty, increasing crime, those kinds of things that are high buck costs to the county budget are shifting to outside the area. Also, sprawling development where we don't have the ability to raise enough property taxes to repair the roads, we haven't planned for the kind of development that's going on. The $24 million worth of unmet road needs, you're going to find is a much higher number when Ron and I report back in August. Remember one statistic about roads. 83% of all county roads are paid for by local property taxes. 70% of that is paid for by urban dwellers. People that live in Holman, West Salem, City of La Crosse, Onalaska, the majority of our property taxpayers are paying for the road system that is funding and supplying services to a sprawling development pattern, and that isn't what we're able to actually keep up with. So it's in our best interest to find a way for the City of La Crosse to reverse the trends and make it more attractive to the middle class, to reinvest in our community and to revitalize, because it's going to impact your property taxpayers as it already has by shifting the cost for county services outside the City of La Crosse as the problems get that much more difficult to solve in the City of La Crosse. We're in this together, but it's really shifting very little enrollment, very little economic development pattern, and shifting costs outside the city of La Crosse. And there aren't a lot of easy solutions.
Did that answer your question, Supervisor Doyle?
Very well, thank you.
And I would encourage folks to look at Carl Green's report, because it really does an even better job than Brian and Steve just did in answering that question with a lot of data to support it. Randy, did you want to add anything on the school district? Okay. Other questions? Supervisor Veenstra.
This is just more of a comment than a question, but I remember when this challenging trends thing was first, we had a large conference, and I remember it was about 4 or 5 years ago maybe, and there was probably at least 100 people at this large collaboration group, and we all split up into groups and things. And it was very refreshing because people from outside the city of La Crosse, all there seemed to be universal acknowledgement of the need to do basically what this is recommending, from mostly private people, not government people. It was recognizing these trends need to be reversed and the way and how to do it. And this, one of the things I guess I would propose is, just in a recent news article about the new garbage ordinance that the city has, and there was a lot of negative sort of vibe in the comments, and people in the newspaper, there were some editorials. It would be helpful if things like that are, the reason that was passed was, I think, because of this. And it needs to be sort of advertised that way. We don't want to have, I live in sort of in the hood, and there's garbage strewn all over the place, and it sucks for that to happen. And who wants to live like that? So that's a positive for the community when we don't have rental properties with garbage strewn all over the place. And it's an, it wasn't really, I mean, it was just in the press, it was just this was passed. It would be great if somebody was constantly on it saying, this is part of what we're doing to try and make the city's neighborhoods better, you know. And I just, I think that would be good to constantly have sort of almost like a PR person on this stuff.
Somebody with bullet points, talking points, maybe. I'm sorry. Supervisor Schrader.
Thank you. I may have missed some of this when I had to take a phone call. I heard Steve O'Malley talking about the infrastructure that's needed to support for the roads I'm talking about. The development in the city. The question came up to me, wouldn't it be better if we channeled that development outside the city rather than in the city where we already have the infrastructure, the new highways, and so on?
Actually, as you'll learn in the presentation we'll do, that Ron will do, we don't have the infrastructure. We have identified in 2007 over $24 million. I think that number is closer to $32 million of just improvements that are needed from a safety and access standpoint that we have no means of funding, just from safety to accommodate the development that's already been there. In addition, most of the developments that are platted out there are not even filled. They're partially filled. Our developers built for a development stream that we are far ahead of the market's ability to absorb that. It's actually the infrastructure of the city that's built more to accommodate a level of development and density that has been declining because the middle class has been leaving and letting homes reverse from residential ownership to rental. That's not sustainable for our city. It's not sustainable in the long term and forces more and more costs to the outlying areas because if and I wish we had that slide where you actually see the decline of total value of the city of La Crosse as a proportion of what's paying for our services. Guess where most of our costs are? In addition to roads, courts, family and children's services, human services, mental health, those tend to be concentrated in the urban areas. And we're shifting the cost of who pays for that to the outlying areas. That's not sustainable for the taxpayers that are paying for it outside the city. It's not sustainable long-term for our city. Our futures are really linked together. And the more we can understand that commonality, I think the better chance we have of solving the problem. So we don't have the right infrastructure. We also can't afford to maintain the roads that we already have. I just talked about the safety improvements. We'll give you a whole lot of bad news in the August presentation on roads.
Yeah, that's enough foreshadowing of doom and gloom. Back to you, Supervisor Schrader.
Yeah, I guess what I was speaking of is, you know, places like LHI and so on, you know, these huge developments that are going into La Crosse, and it takes a lot of highway infrastructure to provide for the people going back and forth. at some point, we're going to have to look outside of the city of La Crosse to develop these type developments, because the city, the infrastructure here can't sustain.
Actually, I'd challenge that. I'd suggest that we need to find a way that the city and county can encourage those folks to not always drive outside the city, to buy and redevelop our neighborhoods, to be a part of what the Gunderson area is talking about, because it's not that there isn't enough demand for housing in Holman and West Salem and Hamilton and other places. It's that there needs to be some of that demand to re-stimulate and harness the new jobs that are being added and redevelop our neighborhoods. Gunderson is a huge employer. LHI is a huge employer. It doesn't mean everybody has to live in town, but if more of those folks with good-paying jobs would help harness and redevelop our neighborhoods, we can see a whole lot of success without putting as much pressure on our road system. So it's not either or, it's both. Yeah.
Other questions? Supervisor Friedland.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment that I think this has been very interesting to watch. When it was presented originally a couple years ago, it almost sounded very unrealistic. It sounded like some donors were going to contribute huge amounts of money that were going to fall down like manna from heaven or something, and that was what was going to be used to finance this program, and everybody was going to get a scholarship, and everything was going to work out perfectly. And I don't know how the program has worked out in other parts of the country. The point was made when we were presented with this several years ago that every community would do things differently and it would grow differently every place. And I think that this has been very interesting to watch. And like Supervisor Veenstra said, there have been small incremental benefits that have developed along the way. And it's been really a very comprehensive approach, almost a real Wisconsin way of doing things that the details are being worked out. The economic development is being highlighted now. The partnerships between the community and private entities are being stressed and built on. And I think that it's really good to watch this. And I personally feel like it's very promising, and I'm very eager to see how it'll go. And it's so good that the future centers have already been funded, and it'll this is important for all of us, and I think we'll all have fun watching it develop.
We can pass your name along to the fundraising committee for the La Crosse Promise.
Well, I do know that the meeting is at 12 o'clock on Friday at the Southside Community Center, if anybody else is interested in going.
Other questions? Supervisor Landry.
A comment. I think that I am the most recent high school graduate in this room. And as by a long shot, probably, but I don't know. Maybe not.
Respect your elders, Supervisor Landry.
Right. As somebody who graduated from Central, I really wish that the future centers would have been there when I was there. I mean, it would have been so incredibly valuable for me, and I have been blessed to have good parents who are really engaged in my education, who are really thoughtful and care about my future, and it was even a challenge for me to afford college. And I think the majority of kids in some school districts don't have that at all. They have parents who have other problems to deal with and priorities than to get their kid an affordable education after high school. And so I just want to say how valuable I think that these future centers are going to be. And I just think that for the future centers in La Crosse Promise, it's exactly what makes our county so great, this county government, and it's exactly what we need to do more of. I think I want to comment also on the work that Brian and Carl and Charlie and Steve and Tara and Rick and everybody else did on the Housing Task Force. It sort of was something that I got thrown into as an intern with the county, and it was such a pleasure for me to be able to spend a summer working on all of that stuff. To be perfectly honest, I really had almost no interest in housing issues and neighborhood redevelopment strategies and that sort of thing. And it sort of just feels like the cause of my life, at least for the moment, to the point where my family bought a house in the Powell-Hamilton neighborhood. I'm really excited about the Gunderson TIF, what that might do for the Powell-Hamilton and Washburn neighborhoods. I can't speak highly enough of the work that Brian and the rest did with community development and what they continue to do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just, in reading some of the documents associated with the La Crosse Promise, it seems that one of the goals is to not only reverse the trend of people moving to the out county, but also to encourage out county people to move back in. And if that's true, I think that also is going to present a problem for the school districts who are going to lose some of those kids who they've already built for. So I think that part of this should include some outreach to the school districts and the communities in the out district to explain what's going on. And I really think that's important because it's I've talked to several school officials and they're, I don't want to say, well, they have questions, and I think that it would be a good PR thing to go to them rather than make them come to the individuals.
Well, I've had a similar conversation with Jerry when we were early working on this. Randy and I haven't recently touched base on this, but I think that's really important because one of the pieces that we hope long-term is that perhaps future centers, maybe not the scholarships, but the future centers could be replicated in other places as well. That if they were able to fund, because the donors right now have funded it for the city of La Crosse, not with government money, but with foundation money, with philanthropy. But we think there are ways of replicating portions of this. We do think that we need to have enough incentive that people want to, are willing to pay higher property taxes to reinvest within the city of La Crosse. Right now, our tax system gives people an incentive to locate outside. So, but you're exactly right. Greater communication with the superintendents and their district would be useful. So good suggestion.
Yeah, and I would also even include the local either townships and city and village governments also, because it affects all of them. If you're trying to incentivize, and the county involved in it, of moving people from the out county back into the city, that certainly has an effect on those other government agencies and the school district.
We will follow up on that suggestion.
Supervisor Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I represent one of the outlying areas outside the city, and I don't find our goals in conflict at all. I find them intricately linked. As goes the core of the apple, so goes the entire apple. And if we don't have a vibrant, healthy, growing inner city, then the outlying areas will be affected by that. And I think as goes the city, so goes the rest of the area. So I'm certainly in support of anything we can do to improve our inner city.
Thank you again, Brian. Thank you, Randy Nelson. Thank you, Rick Staff, for being here this evening and helping us to understand these economic development initiatives. With that, let's move us on to the last agenda item.
Okay, the last agenda item. Do folks, Madam Chair, do you want a break? You want to just move into this? Are people comfortable? We've done, I just don't know how. Okay, keep going. Okay, great. I'm seeing that. The last item, of course, is as our speakers are coming forward, this is one of the largest items, and you'll recall that in our retreat we talked about one of the larger capital items that we'll need to deal with is the Lakeview Capital Facility and the issues that are involved with our long-term challenges with the Lakeview Healthcare Center. Do we have this up on PowerPoint? I have. Okay.
Not say that to Mr. O'Malley, please. Joking. So who will be presenting tonight?
I follow your lead. If you don't want me to keep talking, I will.
Not for as long as it's going to take to get the PowerPoint.
I only have one slide here, so you guys will be pleased with that.
Is yours the first slide?
Mine's the first slide. But I will start talking without it being on the screen. As you know, one of the largest capital items that I've suggested we need to deal with for the 2013 budget is what our decision is with the Lakeview Healthcare Center. We've had a team of people working together on examining what our options are there. It's been led by Mary Ann Strube, our UW Extension department chair, who is excellent at facilitating groups and trying to lead people through discussions, as you've seen in each one of our county retreats and other work groups. She's very skilled at working with people through a process improvement system to identify challenges and discussion. On that team includes Pam Sim, our administrator from Lakeview Health Center, Wanda Placecki, the associate administrator at Lakeview Health Center, Pete Ide, the administrator of Hillview, and Kelly Kramer. Gosh, I just lost her last name. It just left. Kelly Kramer, the associate administrator at Hillview. In addition to that, these discussions have involved financial staff from the finance department and, of course, financial staff from a Lakeview facility as well. What we've done, wow, this is, it's getting close. The introduction is that while we've put this group together, we still believe and will continue to analyze that Lakeview is the most cost-effective solution to meet the needs of low and low-income and difficult-to-serve clients. We are a regional center at Lakeview for difficult-to-serve clients and have done a successful collaboration with other counties across the state. But the Mississippi Valley Health Services, while being very cost-effective in generating approximately $1 million a year that goes to our bottom line to help control property taxes for the operation of Lakeview, it has not solved all of our financial challenges. The facility presents unique challenges to us, and that building was built for a much larger caseload than we currently serve. Our staff will talk about that. And it presents unique challenges because in this large institutional structure, it requires a very high degree of operating costs per square foot, much more less cost-effective than our Hillview facility. And we need to address and make some major decisions about deferred maintenance within the building. We either need to make a final decision to continue to invest in that building and to make it work, or to commit that we're not going to make that investment and look for other options, and that's what we'll be presenting to you tonight. So the team of Lakeview Hillview Administration, led by UW Extension, has met to evaluate options and reduce costs and meet the most pressing issues. So while we're trying to address means of reducing our operating costs right now, we also need to decide which of the three options for facilities we're going to pursue. So the team has developed a recommendation based on what's the best option, we believe, at this point, and we're really at a fork in the road. We need to make sure that the county board is comfortable with or will help make a decision on which of the three options. And I'll just briefly highlight those, and we're going to describe in more detail. One is to commit to the existing facility and continue to remodel it and make other changes in that facility. Great, there we go. Number two is to look at building a much larger and replacement facility, or third is building a smaller set of facilities, much like the Dunn County model. So I'm trying to give you an overview of what the team is going to walk you through as far as the information. What we're asking is not for a decision tonight, but to make sure that we're on the right path of what to do about the Lakeview Healthcare facility, and to bring you to a discussion and a decision on this fork in the road about what to do with the facility. The last item that I'll touch on, so that I'll kind of get to the chase on this, while we will recommend that we use long-term debt to be able to fund the facility, we believe in the financial analysis that we've done so far that the revenue stream from Medicaid, the revenue stream from operations, will make the debt service payment. We will not have to raise property taxes to make the debt payment to build the facility. We will still require a tax levy subsidy, as we do now, to operate the facility, but while we'll use long-term debt to be able to build or remodel or whatever choice you end up agreeing with, we will not have to raise debt taxes to make that payment. It will be paid for from the revenue stream. So that'll hopefully lower people's anxiety about taxes, but understand that this is about what's the best long-term solution for the Lakeview facility. So, Pam, are you going to go first? Thank you, Pam.
Okay. All right. I was hoping maybe we'd go low tech tonight, and our PowerPoint wouldn't work. I think we probably PowerPointed out tonight. On your desk, we did leave a card for you. If you have any questions, we're asking you that you just write them down so we can all get through this relatively quickly for you, and then we'll be open for questions at the end, if that's all right with everybody. I wanted to go into a little bit of our history for those of you that aren't as familiar with Lakeview as some of you. Amazingly, the county purchased the site in 1887, and it opened in 1888 for 24 inmates from Mendota.
Back in the day, they were called Inuits. They were not called residents like we call them today. In 1947, the insane asylum name was changed to La Crosse County Hospital. In 1974, our current building was built, and in 2005, we opened our first community venture, an adult family home in West Salem over by Brennigan Chevrolet. 2007 was a busy year for Lakeview. We opened a state-only lock facility, the very first one in the state, and still only there's one of two in the state. We also opened our second adult family home adjacent to our campus, and we began providing services at the resident care apartment complex across the parking lot. We do not own the building, but we provide the services. 2008 was another busy year for Lakeview. We opened our 14-bed community-based residential facility for people with chronic mental illness and ALDA issues. And we also started our Mississippi Valley Commission with our collaboration with other counties, which some of you have been involved in from the get-go. I also wanted to just run past you our census and where our census comes from. Over the years, we've seen declining census at Lakeview, partly due to MCOs, partly due to Mississippi Valley and the daily rate that they pay. We are licensed for 143 beds. We currently have 118 census. Of that, 82 of those residents are La Crosse County residents. That is a combination of Human Services referrals as well as Western Wisconsin Cares. Our facility for the developmentally disabled is running 7 out of 9. 3 of those are La Crosse County. Ravenwood, which is our state-only lock facility, has 18 beds. Technically, we really only have 14. We did move some beds over there because of a lower bed tax. We are about half full there, and 3 of those residents are from La Crosse County. Maplewood is our CBRF that I told you about, our community-based residential facility. We're licensed for 14, currently have 12. 9 of those are from La Crosse County. And last but not least, our adult family homes, they are both full. We currently have a census of 8. 6 of those are from La Crosse County. So I just wanted to update you a little bit on our census. Stu talked about the planning team. We have many of our colleagues with us tonight. It's been a long, at times torturous, months. I'm sure Mary would attest to that, and Pete. Pete, Kelly, Juana, myself, as well as Mary Ann Strube, along with Gary and his staff, our financial manager. We have also included Jim Spiropoulos from Facilities. And we've also worked with Human Services in the planning process to date. We've reviewed a ton of data, a ton of finances. We've looked at the operating costs, identifying our higher cost areas. We've looked at historical financial data. We've looked at our staffing and our census data. We've looked at other county facilities who are rebuilding or remodeling. We looked at potential new revenue sources, and we've looked at the daily rates for multiple payer sources. And we also looked at our trends in referrals and admissions. And that is just a small part of everything we've been looking at the last several months. And now I'm going to have Wanda and Jim come up and talk to you about some of the operational and infrastructure challenges that we face before we get into our recommendations.
Remember to keep using your index cards to write down questions to keep track of them.
At your chairs tonight was a handout that looks like this, like Lakeview Health Center current situation, and there we do provide some additional detail to the information that we have on the next couple of slides. But just as a reminder to those of you who've been out for a tour recently or those of you who've been in our building before, Pam has talked a little bit about the census information and about some of our other entities, but what we specifically are talking about is the Lakeview Health Center building itself, that building, what services we're providing under that roof. So Lakeview Health Center is getting close to being 40 years old in terms of the building. It was originally built and designed for a younger group of people with chronic mental illness who were ambulatory, needed very little in terms of medical care or care with their ADLs or activities of daily living, but needed a high level of behavior management. The regulations at that time allowed us to provide for that behavior management in a variety of ways that are no longer available to us, and with good reason. We could put people into seclusion, we could use restraints, and we could use chemical restraints, I would say, in terms of medications to really allow us to manage those behaviors in terms of making people probably very sleepy and otherwise incapacitated. So those are no longer available to us, and like I said, with good reason. But if you think about a building that was designed for that group of people, there are very few of those people that we are providing care for in a nursing home setting anymore. Services have changed. Things have changed in terms of the regulatory environment, but also the community and the access to services that people have. And so because of that, we have changed over the years and since the mid-70s, and now we provide services to an entirely different group of people. The people that we provide services to are people generally who are older, who are less mobile, so are using either a walker or a wheelchair, probably needing assistance with that wheelchair or walker to get around at all, are requiring a lot in terms of physical care. Generally speaking, culturally speaking, probably have more bariatric needs, so a person who is heavier, a person who needs more space. They also are coming in with a lot more electronic equipment personally, so more TVs and things of that nature, but also the medical equipment has evolved so that those things that we are needing to care for those people are also requiring things like electricity. And many of our rooms, if you noticed, had one or two outlets. So you think about the space of Lakeview and what it looks like today, who it was designed for. It really has caused, I think, some challenges for us in terms of being able to provide the care that we need to provide, you know, in that setting. So if you're thinking about kind of what's going on with the building, those physical plant issues that really are related to operational and care, kind of that care that we are providing, the rooms are small. They're mostly semi-private, even though a lot of our residents are really requiring private rooms for behavioral or medical reasons. We really have had a building that was designed for all, pretty much all semi-private rooms. Those toilet rooms are shared and very, very small. And if those of you who've been out for a tour recently, you might have seen some of the larger lift equipment that we have that we need to use to help people use the bathroom, to get in and out of bed, to get in and out of their wheelchair. Those cannot even fit in some of our toilet rooms. And if they are in there, the staff can't get in with them. So in terms of staff safety and resident safety, we really have some issues with the space that we have. Of course, it doesn't conform to today's ADA standards. It doesn't provide a lot of space for the kinds of things that people are doing now. We have a full court gym. There aren't a lot of 85-year-olds in wheelchairs that are doing that kind of exercise today. So, you know, thinking about the spaces, the common spaces that we have, it really was built and designed for a very different group of people. In looking at, you know, kinds of what are some of the operational challenges that really are related to the building, staffing is one of those. The way that the building's laid out with those very remote spaces for residents to live on, down those long hallways, contribute to some very inefficient staffing patterns. It's hard to share staff amongst living areas. It's hard to mix resident groups. So we've got people with elderly people, frail elders. Then we have elderly and not so elderly people with Alzheimer's or other related dementias. Then we have younger people with chronic mental health issues. And we also have people of all ages that have developmental disabilities. Those people don't really mix really well in terms of a living environment together. So it's good to have them separated, but by the same token, it's very difficult then to have an efficient staffing pattern because each of those areas then needs additional staff. In addition, because as I mentioned before, we don't have those regulatory allowances that allow us to manage behavior in a certain way, we need things like additional staff, for instance, to manage those kinds of behaviors. So if a person is wandering or going into other residents' rooms or maybe gets into altercations with other residents, we have to have sometimes two staff to one resident in order to effectively manage that behavior. So again, the staffing patterns, there aren't places for people to roam freely and be safe about it. We're ending up staffing at an additional cost to the facility. Also, because of the way that we're set up, everybody comes in that one main door, everyone goes down those hallways and then spreads out to get to their living area, it's been very difficult for us to look at some additional revenue streams that could be helpful to us in offsetting those losses that we have under Medicaid. For instance, Medicare. We have never been able to really figure out how to provide a more of a rehab setting because, again, of that mix of population groups. It doesn't work very well if you have people that are unable to really be cared for in a rehab setting that need the long-term care, might need that extra staffing, might not understand that they can't go into that resident's room and mess with their rehab equipment, for instance. So we have not been able to segregate enough of a space to really look at being able to provide a Medicare rehab living area. We have also not been able to attract a whole lot of private pay individuals, again, because those people generally have choice in amongst the seven facilities in La Crosse County. Only two of them are county. And they are choosing facilities, again, that they feel has an environment that's a little bit different than what we can provide at this time. So, again, it provides us with very limited sources of revenue. Our primary source, of course, is Medicaid, and that does not cover the cost of care. And then, again, I think for a variety of reasons, many of them good reasons, for instance, family care, coming and providing support and assistance to people to remain in the community or to live in the community, we have seen a declining census as we've talked about a little bit since 2008. Jim is going to talk a little bit about kind of the building issues that really are contributing to some of the additional costs we have.
I get to bring you more good news, like I did last month. I guess you have it up there. Back in 2008, Lakeview had a study done by Vantage Architects. I'm sorry, is that better? Back in 2008, Lakeview had a study done by Vantage Architects locally to look at the building, look at the utilities, to see what it would take to bring the building back up to the 1980s when it was built. At that time, they prioritized the levels in level 1, 2, and 3. And Steve and I both have a book. I believe Lakeview has one, so if any board member would like to look at these, just let us know, and we can make them available. The three levels that they had, building upgrades under this priority, which is level 1, should receive attention as soon as practical. Further deterioration may affect weather resistance, building operations, and their immediate maintenance costs. I'm not going to go through each one of them because there's probably 50 different categories within the three levels. But basically, they looked at the building, talked to staff, and figured out which ones would be priorities. Probably the biggest cost to Lakeview in comparison to Hillview is the utility costs. They're both similar size buildings. Their functions are a little bit different. Just as a comparison, Hillview runs about $1.36 a square foot for all their utilities. Lakeview, on the other hand, runs $2.44 a square foot. The county recently had a study done by Focus on Energy on all of our county buildings. Most of them came in below average statewide for utilities. Lakeview was way high in the average cost for utilities compared to other like facilities in the state. So utility costs are very costly out there. They're an ongoing cost. We need to get some efficiencies out there. The next three items, the boilers, air handlers, and temperature controls. The boilers are 30 years old, and everything else is 37-plus years old. None of that has been replaced except for the boilers about 7 years into Lakeview. The old boiler plant was decommissioned and boilers were installed in the building itself. Again, it leads to the number one cost out there, which is utilities. We don't have much for efficiencies built into those systems because of how they were designed 37 years ago. The next one is roofs. Most of the roofs have been replaced from the original building, but a lot of them are in need of replacing now. That's one of the things under the deferred maintenance. We deferred them as long as we can, and we're going to have to start replacing them. Parking areas, and a lot of this stuff you can see on the boards that I provided over here. The parking areas on the campus are deteriorating to the point where they're going to become a gravel road pretty soon. That's a major cost out there that we're going to have to incur in probably within the next 5 years. Stormwater management. We've done a couple of drainage areas around the building. When it rained, it used to rain inside the building. In other words, the water used to run towards the building because the way it was designed, there's a frontage road or an access road all the way around the building that was actually installed higher than the floor in the building. So everything ponds within that. So we've put a few drains in. We haven't solved all the problems, so we've got some work to do there. Along with 90% of the stormwater on the site drains to the village. You can just about imagine what kind of stormwater fee we're going to have eventually. Deferred maintenance, again, boilers. We have 5 steam and 7 hot water boilers out there. Two of the five steam boilers are operational at this point. 3 of them are not. And that was by design. We took some of the kitchen equipment that used to feed off from the steam boilers and put new equipment in to run on electric so we can get by with 1 or 2 steam boilers. But as those continue to deteriorate, we're going to have to make a decision whether we're going to stick money back into that steam equipment to feed a couple of air handlers. Capital costs over the past 5 years have been minimal at best. The facility out there is just trying to get by operationally, so we had to defer a lot of capital costs. A lot of what's going to be talked about next is the pros and cons to staying in the existing building. I guess I just want to share, if we take and remodel the existing building, the numbers you're going to hear are only to get the building back to where it was. It isn't going to talk about staging the residents and the staff during the renovation and equipment upgrades, and it's certainly not going to address the future needs of Lakeview in the operations that they do. Remember what the building was built for, and now we need to take it for the next 30 years and take it down the road. So I'll give it back to Wanda and then stick around for questions.
One of the first things that the Planning Committee looked at was this 2008 Vantage architectural study to look at whether or not this upgrade or repair was going to be possible and feasible and how much it really was going to cost based on the information that we had. And like Jim said, it is about a $12 to $13 million cost updated. They recently updated the study for us to 2012 costs. So we're looking at $12 to $13 million to get us back to a building that was designed for people 40 years ago. It doesn't do anything. That $12 to $13 million does not address what it will cost us to stage all of the different areas, to move the residents, to perhaps put up some semi-permanent or temporary structures for people and for some of our systems. It doesn't include the issues that we would have with that staging, the length of time it would take us to do that. We do know anecdotally that one facility in the state recently did a major renovation of their entire building, and it was about a 3-year process for them. And the costs were significantly more than what they originally had intended because of all of the issues. Not to mention, again, putting people of different need areas into one space, probably putting people into semi-private rooms or more,
and that may need private spaces, etc. So it didn't look at any of that. It also didn't look at any continued decline in the building structure since 2008. So when they updated the study, they looked at what they had identified in 2008 and just projected out what it would cost to do exactly what they said in 2008. So it doesn't do that. It doesn't look at things that might have moved up into a higher priority level in the last 4 years also. And I think the most important thing that it doesn't do is it doesn't address the current care philosophy of having those smaller neighborhoods in order to provide care to a variety of different settings. And it doesn't help us to plan for the future. What it will do is get us back to a nursing home that functions well physically. It doesn't provide us with any flexibility in the licensing piece, which, as you would see in other options, we would have more flexibility as the needs of the community changes. We would have the ability to license different spaces in different ways. This does not do that. So, again, it gets us back to a building that was designed 40 years ago, and it designed to be used as a nursing home. So if you look at kind of those options in terms of the pros and cons, you know, it will offer us improved utility costs, obviously, but maybe not maximizing those costs because of, again, if you were there, those long hallways, the high ceilings, those types of things. And then we're looking at some of the things that we think would be issues. It provides us with the lowest reimbursement rates of the options renewed. As Steve had mentioned, the Medicaid rate, it has a couple of different ways that it funds two different pieces. It funds operations, or partially funds operations, and then funds kind of that debt service piece. So there's two different parts of the MA rate. And under some of the options that we will be discussing, the state actually offers incentives in the operational side. So on an ongoing basis, even after the building is built, it provides financial incentives to do things a certain way. It does not provide those options to renovate an existing structure. So there wouldn't be any of those available in terms of in helping us to improve our current Medicaid rate. It also doesn't provide us with, again, like I said, the flexibility to change licensures as we need it. It would prohibit us from the development of new revenue streams. Again, it doesn't give us those opportunities to have the private rooms, private baths that we, you know, really are looking at needing, et cetera. So that I think is really, you know, if you haven't guessed by now, we are not, I think, recommending at this time that we look at that as an option. We feel that it doesn't do what we need it to do even to meet current resident needs, and it certainly doesn't address anything that might happen in the future. But Pam is going to talk a little bit about options 2 and 3, which really are more desirable in terms of what they can do for the facility.
As Wanda said, we really, I'm not quite as tall as Wanda, I have to move this down a little bit. We looked at all three of these options extensively. In fact, we looked at multiple options and narrowed it down to these three. And we do not recommend the remodel option for the reasons that she went through. But we did not feel that we should jump to option 3 immediately. So we did look at, from Steve's direction, at option 2, which is a replacement with a large institutional facility. This would be a single-story dwelling with one or more entrances. It would have private rooms and baths. It would be a modified model of option 3 that we're going to be presenting. It would have living areas open to a larger central core. It would replace our nursing facility with one large facility similar in size. It would house our nursing home. And it could include our licenses of our facility for developmentally disabled, our CBRF, and our state only, which are in our current facility. We could consider this model as being advantageous for Medicare certification over our present model because of how it would be designed. We could also look at some new services, such as detention beds, and those are some of the services we've been looking at for our revenue sources.
It does meet consumer demand for a more home-like environment, which our remodel would not do. Because of the way they're building now, they're building all private rooms with private baths. That's what consumers want. It would meet that demand. It also obviously would have significant energy savings over our current structure, even with the remodel. It would provide a little bit more of a staffing efficiency because we'd be building with the long, long corridors and the separation of the building. It would allow for some of the property allowance that Wanda talked about. Now, there would not be operational incentives with this option, but there would be a property incentive for rebuilding versus remodel. This would help cover the cost of any capital. It would provide for some reduction in the tax levy, and it would provide more opportunities for choice and flexibility into the future. I believe I've covered everything in the pros and cons, but it is still an institutional model. When you think of the large traditional facility, it is more of a traditional model. It's more of an institutional model. It is not supported by the state, as the third option is. It could limit some of our new revenue streams that we might have more flexibility in a smaller building with the household concept. It does kind of limit our inability to meet future needs as well. We're looking well into the future. We're looking 20, 30 years in the future. I was kidding at our committee meeting this morning saying that Roger and I don't want to go in the nursing home when we come in, but we might want to go into a behaviorally focused CBRF. He wants to go into the RCAC. So, and that's what you get, Roger, for calling me Sam Penn. I couldn't resist that. He got my name a little backwards this morning. Based on what we've discussed already with the remodel and the replacement with the large institutional facility, we are recommending that we not replace our building with a large facility, and you'll see more why when I get to option three, because there are more incentives with option three. Option three was the final option that we looked at. It's replacement with a small neighborhood facility. This is the latest trend in long-term care and in community living, where you build several small facilities. Generally, they are 50 beds or less at the present time. The state is considering increasing that size to 60. It is a new model. It's a small household model. You have neighborhoods of 10 to 20 residents in a household. Then these are each, you have up to 50 beds in each of these small facilities. And many of these houses can add up to a larger facility without having that institutional large facility feel. The small house contains private resident rooms, private bathrooms, but then you have a large communal kitchen and dining area where they gather communally in their household to have their meals and their recreational therapies. The goal is to integrate the individualized care needs of residents within the rhythms of their daily life and to put them with individuals that are like in sense with them. We would have our dementia residents that Wanda mentioned in one household, and maybe next into that same building, but in another household, we might have some folks with just frail elders with medical needs. It focuses on a home-like setting. It provides nursing assistants or universal workers with different opportunities and responsibilities. We can have better staffing efficiency because we can combine responsibilities in this model. Right now we have staff that serve meals, do activities, and do care. In the universal worker concept, which we use in this option, they combine those responsibilities. So there are multiple opportunities for efficiencies of staffing in this. Probably what you want to hear, though, is why is this the best model? It's because it gets the best reimbursement from the state. The state endorses this model more than any other model. We not only get the property incentives that Wanda talked about, we also get a Medicaid add-on incentive for operations. None of the other models provide that opportunity, and we did discuss that a little bit this morning at our committee meeting. It does meet consumer demand for the home-like environment and the private rooms. obviously significant energy savings again. It provides a model of care for the new care facilities. And one of the other big advantages of this option is that it allows us to look into the future. The models, which Jim has posted up there, a model of a facility that's currently being built in this philosophy, allows us to look into the future, and it's built at the capacity to meet all the codes for nursing homes, any form of assisted living. And so you can convert spaces down the road. 10 years down the road, if we're not going to have a nursing home wing anymore for this, and it's going to be a community-based option, like a resident care apartment complex or a community-based residential facility, these are all built to all those codes so that it can be converted very easily with minimal cost. They are a little bit more complicated to plan, and they are difficult to understand because they're very new. And again, we have not planned to repurpose our building yet. We have no idea at this point in time what we're going to do with our old building if we do move to a new building. And so that is one of the cons of moving out of the current structure. But after a review of all of the things that we looked at over time, the biggest incentive from the state is the MA incentives for the small facilities. It gives us the property tax allowance. It gives us the $10 add-on for operational costs, which the other ones we are recommending that we go with a small neighborhood replacement facility. And I think, Steve, you were going to finish up with the recommendation, if I recall.
Pam summarized it pretty well, that in looking through the options that that they've considered, it seems that the option three is the most clear, provides the most flexibility, the best potential for lower costs of both operations in ongoing tax levy, as well as a number of efficiencies. But if we go to the next slide, this is really where we'd like to request that the board consider a resolution at one of your future meetings to ratify or agree with this recommendation. My questions for you to consider as you've been listening, we've tried to go through a lot of information in a relatively short period of time on just this topic, is number one, should we devote additional time to analyzing options one or two? For example, if people feel that we haven't spent enough time on analyzing what the potential options and costs would be for remodeling the existing building, we could spend more time on developing a transition plan. How would we site clients off-site out of the building as we're remodeling? Would we bring in temporary facilities? What would be the transition for that? Would there be an opportunity to do major demolition and remodeling to get private rooms somehow? What level of architectural analysis would we have to do to spend more time on trying to retrofit that existing facility? It's in our analysis at this point that while the initial cost looks like a much lower number, if we spent a lot more time on architectural analysis, a lot more time on repurposing the building to have private rooms, that would be prohibitively costly. Or cost prohibitive based on the amount of investment we'd have to do, as well as we'd have to have temporary spaces for clients and employees to work and live in during the transition or remodeling. So it's our analysis that it's not worth spending more time on analyzing the cost of option number one, but we want to see if you concur with that. Option two also locks us into a larger institutional model. Rock County chose to do that. We've got all of their information. We can get more information there. But again, Rock County is a county about twice our size. They serve only their county. They don't serve any other counties. They're not a regional facility and would lock us into a large institutional model. So the first question is to ask you to consider, do we need to devote additional time to that, or are you comfortable with us pursuing, not making a decision on option three, but saying that's where you want us to spend more time and energy rather than option number one or two? Is there additional information needed to make that decision, and any issues not addressed to consider a resolution to say option three is the one we're going to spend more time on, figuring out the details of design, cost, transition? And the next steps by your staff will be to develop more fully. We are going back through and reanalyzing and confirming our analysis from 7 years ago that there is no other alternative for La Crosse County other than to be in the business of the Lakeview Healthcare Center. You may recall that as we began to explore the collaboration with other counties, our Human Services Department, independent of Lakeview staff, identified that if we were not in the business of providing Lakeview Health facility, it would cost us more to provide care for those clients that we are responsible for, not the other counties, but just our own clients in alternative facilities. It would cost us more than staying in the business. So Human Services staff and Lakeview staff are going back and reanalyzing that and making sure that we can confirm, and we still believe that's true, we need to provide this level of service to our clients. Secondly, we're reviewing the cost-benefit of who we serve. If we go with the third option, which is similar to the Dunn County model, which is the example on the board, we need to reexamine, do we serve only La Crosse County clients? Do we serve only La Crosse County clients and Western Wisconsin Care? Or do we also continue to be a regional facility for other counties as we are now? Because some level of downsizing has to happen. You recall that the facility was built for a much larger census than we currently serve. We've seen a decline of census of 17% from 2008 to now. How do we project out our future census? What's the cost benefit of us staying in the business of being a regional entity? Is it still in La Crosse County's best interest to serve other entities? So we really need to dig deep and reexamine those issues, and that's what staff's starting to work on. We don't have recommendations at this point, but we realize that we're at this fork in the road of having to make a decision about which model do we pursue. We believe the first two are dead ends. The third option gives us the most flexibility and that we can re-examine who we are here to serve and what is the cost effectiveness of being more than just La Crosse County. We need to make sure of that. In addition to that, the third bullet point is site plan and location. If we are not going to be remodeling the existing building, which had been the path that we're on, we have in our capital budget over $547,000 worth of capital for this calendar year to start doing that work. If we're not going to spend that money, where do we locate on campus? What are our options for site? The existing road in front of Lakeview has not been upgraded to provide a separate site. What other locations do we have to consider there? And finally, evaluating options for repurposing the facility. Is there another use for the Lakeview building as it is right now if we don't remodel it, if we don't stay in that building, and what is the timeline? What else can happen with that building? Is it does it just need to be demolished? Can it be repurposed for another use by another entity? What options are there? So these are the kinds of questions and next steps we believe that need to be analyzed. But we needed to take a deep breath and say, is the board with us on the options that we've gotten? Have we given you enough information to make a decision that option three is the one to pursue more fully and to bring you back information on how to make that decision as part of our 2013 budget?
So let's try to work our way through those three questions on the top of the screen. Whether or not staff should devote additional time to options one or two. Thoughts, questions, comments? Supervisor Schrader.
This question is for Steve. Did you say that you were going to work on whether we should even be in the business now, the financials on that?
Right. We're going to fundamentally reexamine and make sure that we can assure you that if we were not in the business, it would cost us more. And we want to give you up-to-date numbers on what that analysis is.
How long will that be, do you think?
That will be part of our as we're analyzing option three, it's fundamental to that. What size do we – if, for example, one option is you do the smaller three-bed or three buildings, but you only need one because you're only going to size for La Crosse County only. What's the cost effectiveness of that? Is there another alternative to us not providing that service? But, yes, we want to go back at ground zero. If we're going to build this facility for the next 20 to 30 years, we need to make sure that we're sizing it right and that this is the best cost alternative for us to stay in the business. And if not, we need to be able to share with you that information.
Supervisor Downer.
Madam Chair, thank you. First of all, I want to thank Jim Spiropoulos for putting together the tour out there for us. If you have not gone out there in the last couple of years, please go out there and take a look and see what that facility is like. I'm not going to make any comments on it other than the fact that in another life, I used to be involved in manufacturing, going through facilities and looking at it. I've done a quick analysis of the facility out there, which I will not comment on at this point in time. But you heard Steve O'Malley make the comment, and this is one that the county is going to have to do, and that is going to be the commitment that La Crosse County is going to have to make for residents of La Crosse County and the area, individuals with mental health issues, and that is going to have to be made by a commitment by us here as we go through this process right here. I can tell you, no matter what of the three options that we are going to use, it's going to be a lot of work because I spent a lot of work up at the Tomo VA Medical Center, and I know what they've gone through and what they've got and what they do up there. And whether you go on option one, two, or three, it's going to be a lot of work across the board. So I just want to put that in. Thank you.
Supervisor Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve O'Malley, you said three buildings. If we go option three,
we would analyze up to three buildings. That's just as an initial starting point. It seems to meet the census that we have right now, utilizing the Dunn County model, which is sized very similar to what the number of clients we currently serve.
And with the group we're with, you think there's people wanting openings to fill those buildings with? You think we'd be able to fill the buildings with no problem?
With the clients we currently serve now, give or take a certain number of beds, that's what we would analyze. But we believe that the three-bed model would keep us in the nursing home, FDD, state-licensed beds, and the CBRF. Sorry, I can't do that from memory.
Okay, thank you.
Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of a time frame are we looking at for a decision? Is it 1 year down the road, 2 years, 3 years? What? Because it'd be nice to see the other project done, to go up and look at a facility done rather than...
It would be. I don't think we're going to have that luxury. My estimate is if you do pick option three and want more information, is that in the 2013 budget, you would budget for a design process that during the winter would go into design, and my hope would be to break ground sometime next year. See, one of the challenges is that in addition to the deferred maintenance on the building, the cost of operating that existing facility is becoming more and more difficult. We've been able to make it through the last year and a half because of the Mississippi Valley Health Services money that we weren't able to access. Remember when we first started, the state said after we started that we couldn't access the money because they challenged whether or not we could legally do MVHS, even though we were already charging people. We had to keep that money aside. That's actually helping us operate now. We will be in a more difficult financial position by the end of 2013. We don't have all the things solved, but the point is that we don't have the luxury of waiting a year or two. We need to pick a direction and try to make it work and take it a step at a time.
So you're looking at breaking ground in 2013?
That would be my goal. I don't know how realistic that is, but that's the hope, and we need to develop a plan to see if that can happen, and what are the choices, what are the design costs, how long will it take to design, are we able to use a modified structure of what Dunn County did as an example and minimize the design time, or will it take us longer than I've projected? We've not engaged an architect on this yet because we don't have your blessing to take that next step. Before we start spending money with architectural and site plan and those kinds of things, we really needed to get to this point with you. So this really is a 2013 process. If we can't break ground till 2014, that will delay this, and there are a number of issues that will be involved, but we will take this a step at a time and bring you the choices. You will make those choices as we go along.
Thank you, sir.
What's the status of the Dunn County facility? That I mean, to part of Supervisor Ebert's question that I heard was, can we go and look at that?
Yeah, it's broken ground, but it's not.
I was raising my hand over there so I could answer that question, Supervisor Ebert. Dunn County broke ground just in June of this year, but I did get an email from their administrator today because he knew we were coming here tonight, and he said any of the supervisors can go to the Dunn County website. They have just instituted a webcam where they will be doing ongoing flashes to their web page, which will show you the progress of the facility. Unfortunately, it doesn't feel that there's going to be enough of the facility up for a tour much before spring. You know, they're going to be doing walls this fall, and they're pouring concrete in a few weeks, but there isn't going to be enough of an infrastructure to really get a feel for the building till spring. But I did encourage you to all go on the Dunn County website. They do have an ongoing webcam that's monitoring the progress of the construction.
Was that it for you, Supervisor Ebert? Supervisor Veenstra.
Thank you.
We followed directions and wrote down questions on his index card while the presentation was happening.
A question regarding the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Is it likely to have any effect on the reimbursements we're getting in the future?
The Affordable Care Act does have some good
incentives. You need to use the mic, please, Pete.
It's kind of short and sweet. They do have some good incentives for Medicaid. The feds are going to maybe reimburse up to 95%, we're hearing. But I'm also hearing some states may opt out. So the answer is we don't know.
Another question, this may be for, I don't know if you talked about this at the committee or not, but did the estimates that we have include any options with regard to the sustainability goals that we have indicated we want to try to follow if possible?
Go ahead.
The Dutton County model is probably the greenest of the models. They are going geothermal. They are not going to be LEED certified, but they're going to be LEED-like, and that is what we would strive for as well.
All right. The only thing I guess I wanted to comment on was we're never going to borrow any cheaper than we could now. That's a realistic thing we need to consider.
Supervisor Holtz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have toured the facility recently, and it has a lot of work. I personally can't see putting 12, 13, maybe more, because we haven't updated those numbers sufficiently, into an old building that's been well done. It's still an old building. And it's sized incorrectly. So to my position personally is that upgrading that building is not really a very viable option. If that's the case, and if we're going to stay in the business, which hasn't totally been determined yet, then we've got two choices, either another big box or a modular setup that you can build onto as you need rather than trying to build it all at one time. To me, there's no question, but the phase option three would be the way to go. That's assuming that we're going to continue in the business, assuming what our market is going to be. Are we just going to provide for our people? Are we going to market it to other entities to use and help our costs? Or are we even going to stay in the business? So those have to be answered. But any future looking, to me, makes sense to go look at the third option if we're going to do anything. Thank you.
Supervisor Berg. Microphone, please.
Oh, I'd like to just second the supervisor spoke before me. This point, I think the first piece of information we need before we can make any other decisions is whether or not it makes sense for us to stay in the should the County of La Crosse be in the nursing home business. And until we have those numbers, I don't think we can make any other decisions. I mean, there's no point in drawing up architectural plans if you're never going to build the building. So do we have an idea of when we can get those numbers on what it's going to cost us? And
that will be part of the budget process. The way I saw this going is that if the board is comfortable with a resolution to pick option three, contingent upon confirming size, whether or not we are in the business, we would not start architectural design until the 2013 budget. That would be a budget line item. We don't have a line item right now for architectural design. So it's part of something that would happen sequentially at the same time as part of the 2013 budget is my recommendation.
Supervisor Plesha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand, the Dunn County model is something that was just recently approved within, a year or so? It's something that it's a new model, it's a new idea, and it's probably a well worth exploring idea. We have many different types of clients that are out at the nursing home, as it was called, the Lakeview Healthcare Center. And there is mainly one door. When you open up that door, you can go in, and people are all over the place. I think that they all have different needs and all have different abilities, and frankly, they all have different, we have different ways that we would like to have them served. So anyway, I guess this smaller model is probably the easiest way to maintain staffing as well as the number of people that are, housed in one unit. We do have some other interesting things which I wasn't planning on talking about tonight, but I do have some friends that have just recently found that Lakeview was the place of choice. And it is definitely an institution. I don't like saying that. We've kept it as good as we have, as long as we have, but it's starting to look more and more like an institution. And frankly, community-based residential facilities are really the way to go. They're smaller, they're more efficient, they make more of a housing unit. The other model of going back to the institution and going to the larger facility is really not meeting the needs of today's population. So those are just things we need to look at and understand. You know, you've been out to visit Lakeview and you see the inefficiencies that it does have right now, but it is an old building. And, you know, you'd like to see these, me speaking from a man who lives in an 1860s house, there is a difference. Some facilities just need to be looked at in a way when you're spending total costs of $341,000 a year for utility costs in a building that could be much more efficient than that. I think that right now is throwing money away. And staffing is another cost that we have to look at. So, yes, we do have to answer all these questions, and I don't want to be the one to, you know, say one way or the other. I'm just giving you my two cents worth. Thank you.
Supervisor Hampson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the numbers that we're going to need to look at that may astonish some people is looking at the cost of relocating the current residents to appropriate settings elsewhere in the state. Because of the unique nature of Lakeview and their clients, they require very specialized care. So it's not like we can just farm them out to, you know, any of the homes in town. They're going to need to go to state institutions, and I don't even know where some of them would go if they weren't at Lakeview. So that's going to be just prepare yourself for a really, really big number. And then we also have to look at the other counties that are currently involved in the Mississippi Valley Health Services. And they would be facing similar costs to move their patients elsewhere. And I think one of the questions we need to address to them is how committed would they be to us keeping them, but at an increased cost. So there's some big numbers coming up. That's all. Thanks.
Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to say I really appreciate the strong vision of our leadership team and your willingness to think, as Pam mentioned, 20 and 30 years ahead. I think that's just really important when it comes to a building project and really meeting the future needs of our citizens. To me, the two questions that come to mind, you asked the question, should we option one, option two, option three. To me, I came up with two questions in the order of importance. Number one, which model best meets the needs of both our residents and staff? And number two, which model best allows for future growth? And I'm hearing, without question, that model three or option three is absolutely the best way to go. So I guess in terms of number one, I would say we need to devote more time to option three. But I really do appreciate the fact that you're looking into the future growth and how we can best, as Supervisor Holtz mentioned earlier, it's important to be able to allow for future growth with this kind of operation. Thank you.
Supervisor Landry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question actually is related to future growth and what was mentioned before about the Affordable Care Act. What do we know if that's going to affect the number of clients or patients that we're going to be dealing with in our facility or not?
Could we go back to the census slide just to give you an example? This issue around need is really our, and with the declining trend of clients, that's really the crystal ball question. It's both what can we afford, what's going to be the needs, how flexible can we be, and of this census, you'll notice that roughly what the current La Crosse County census is 103. That's a little bit misleading because of those 82 that are at the top, I think it's 35 are Western Wisconsin Cares. I'm doing this from memory. It changes.
No, I checked it today.
Okay, what is it?
I figured it would come up. Sorry, not used to mic. Of the, is it 103? In the nursing home, of the La Crosse 82, 47 are La Crosse County Human Services, 35 are Western Wisconsin Cares.
Right. However, if we were not in the business, Western Wisconsin Cares would need to find other places to serve them. However, if they disenroll from Western Wisconsin Cares, they would still be our responsibility. So that's the moving target we have to talk about, because the numbers that we did 7 years ago indicated that at the census levels then, La Crosse County would have to spend approximately $3.5 million a year to take care of clients if we were not in the business, over and above our existing levy. So we don't expect to find a lot of new information, but we're going to re-examine every dollar. We're going to re-examine what exactly we would do with each one of these clients. The adult family homes that are listed there are cost-effective. They don't need to be relocated. Those eight clients, they're fine. I think six of them are La Crosse County. It's really relocating all of the other clients. So we will re-examine this and say, if we are not in the business and Western Wisconsin Cares has to provide service, what is our client's only need, the 47 that we just talked about, and do we have other alternatives? We do not believe that there are other alternatives with the downsizing of Mendota and the other state institutions, and those clients are our responsibility. But looking out 10 to 20 years, what length of time will we need to meet that need? And so that's the level of flexibility we're going to have to analyze, and that's, again, why the three smaller bed facilities, you can change licensing based on need. But that is the fundamental question here. It's not just about which facility. The fundamental question is, how long do you need to be in that business, and is it more cost-effective for us to be in the business than others to serve? We are the residential facility for the region right now. If you talk to the private sector nursing homes, they will tell you that we are the ones that they rely on when a client can't be served in their nursing home. When somebody's behavior is so bad that they can't be served at your standard nursing home, we are the ones that are the fail-safe. And in fact, maybe we should engage the private sector in talking about why we need to be in the business or not, because that's the feedback we've had from private sector nursing homes over quite some time about that. So that's an important issue. But I thought the numbers might help you. It's not three or four clients. It's the majority of the clients or significant number that we need to provide care for. At least we're responsible under state law.
Did that answer your question, Supervisor Laundrie?
I was trying to answer several questions that were still lingering there. So
I guess my specific question is that I've heard a lot about the increased number of patients that, if the entire Affordable Care Act is implemented in every state the way it was intended to be, that there's going to be an increase in the number of patients that every hospital, every institution around the country is going to have to deal with. So my question is, do we have to factor in a potential increase in the number of patients generally that we're going to be dealing with because of that?
I think if that became true, yes, we would have to factor that in, not necessarily into the nursing home, but if they're going to become Medicaid eligible, there's going to be referrals through Western Wisconsin Cares. There's going to be referrals through our human services organization, and we could get increased referrals both to the nursing home as well as to our community entities, but other nursing homes as well, not just Lakeview.
Those are all the hands that I saw for first-time questions. Oh, Supervisor Geary.
Yeah, a lot of this talk is about right-sizing, getting the right size. Well, if we're going to get the right size, then somehow we got to get the private sector involved. How many of these residents can they absorb? We've got, 11 private sector nursing homes in the county? Is it 11, 10 or 11? Are they going to the smaller building concept, or would they get into the business? I can see why they'd send a disruptive patient up there, because if they got one or two, it isn't cost-effective for them to deal with it. But if they were given the opportunity to be the one that provided the service and build a building for 10 or 20, would they move into that area?
While they're coming up, remember that over 90% of all the clients that we serve at Lakeview are Medicaid.
Right.
The reason we're stuck in the business is because we're the ones that will pay the gap, because Medicaid doesn't cover the full cost of care. Private sector nursing homes are able to, much like Hillview, to have a larger proportion of their clients be private pay. At Hillview, about 35% of our clients are private pay, paying a higher rate. Medicaid is still under reimbursing the rest of the clients at Hillview, but they're able to balance that out. The private sector specializes in serving easier-to-serve clients and also having a larger portion that are private pay. But Pete knows this more than
I. On that, I thought you said that we're going to get better reimbursements now.
Right, but it still won't cover the full cost of care. It'll reduce some of the deficit, but it will not. We won't make it up in volume, let me put it that way.
Well, as usual, Mr. O'Malley hit it on the head. The private nursing homes, and Hillview is one of them, a not-for-profit entity, they're not looking to add Medicaid clients. We're looking to add Medicare clients. Every nursing home who has Medicare makes money on Medicare. We get paid about $400 a day on average on Medicare. Private pay, we break even or make slightly amount. But Medicaid, we lose $60 a day. So no one's looking to build a facility to fund it with the challenging Medicaid clients that you lose $60 per day times 365 days. No one's looking to do that. Now, the trend to build smaller nursing home is going to grow. Nobody wants to build the big boxes anymore. But to answer your questions, nobody's looking for Lakeview clients. To build a new private room and private bathrooms, brand new facility, that's something nice, but no one's looking for Lakeview's clients. Our clients that we can't manage go to Lakeview.
Okay, my other point is I think these other counties in the consortium should be looking at building their own. If 10 or 20 is cost effective, they're sending them here because they didn't have a big enough number to provide the service. So shouldn't they be looking into getting into that type of facility themselves?
Sure. I was going to just respond a little bit to your first. The second half of the would other facilities take these residents speaks to kind of the process that we use right now when we have a referral to Lakeview. Because of the MVHS, because of that consortium that we have, because of that commission, we have a process where they are looking at every referral. Each county, we do have to get authorization from each county of responsibility prior to admission. That was new after MVHS was created. They don't want to spend $60 a day to send people to Lakeview, additional above and beyond our Medicaid rate, if they don't have to. So other counties like Monroe, like Trempealeau, like Vernon, who have county facilities, have put a tremendous amount of pressure on those facilities to accept those clients. So when a resident does come into our facility, it is because no other facility currently that's in our region will accept them. And in looking at, you know, if you're looking at sheer numbers, of sheer economy of scale, if Vernon County has 13 or 14 and Monroe County has 10 and Sauk County has one or two, they won't be interested or really be able to build a facility that they could actually fund and run that's that small. We're talking about 50 beds or less. There are very few facilities that, you know, under that 35 to 50 bed, that really are able to look at any way of making it. So to build a 10-bed standalone facility with the dining space that you need, with the kitchen built to code, probably wouldn't be something that any other county that's currently in our commission would be interested in or able to do.
Okay, but when we come to a number to build and we're anticipating providing for these counties, are they under some kind of long-term obligation with us to make us, you know, the proportional payment or whatever?
That's exactly the question we have to ask. We have to start off, first of all, is there any other way that we can provide service to these clients effectively by not being in the business? If we agree that that's the analysis, secondly, do we serve La Crosse County only? Or is it more cost-effective because of economies of scale to serve the others? We need to answer that question for you. We haven't finished that analysis, but it's based on this third option. Again, we're at a fork in the road. We don't have enough information for you to be comfortable making this final decision and say, yes, go ahead and build it, go ahead and design it, who are we serving? We're just saying that based on the three ranges of options, the only way we think this makes sense is on that third option. We have a whole lot more answers to give you before you're ready to say, yes, we want to build that. We had struggled on whether or not to bring this whole thing to you at once and say, here it is, the analysis is done. But we had feedback from board members from the earlier, we do the monthly report where you read information. There were questions, I believe it was by Sharon Hampson, saying, well, who's making this decision about what kind of facility to do? And we recognize we're at a fork in the road where we're saying options number one and two are dead ends. If we have an option that makes sense that you're going to be comfortable being asked to make a decision on, it's in option three. But it is about how big do we make it? Do we serve La Crosse County only? Is there a reason that other counties are committed to it? Do they have to pay part of the capital? Do they pay a higher amount because their clients are coming here and they're not the taxpayers that are actually selling the debt? All those kinds of questions have to be asked and answered before you're going to be ready to vote on that final decision.
So let's hear one more question from Supervisor Meyer, and then we'll try and bring some closure to this discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be quick. We talked a lot about the Dunn County facility. Does anyone here, I don't know who answers this, is there any facility like that in Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota that we could actually go see? The team.
There is one facility over by Oshkosh. It's not exactly like the Dunn County model, but it is the smaller model of the homes. What's the name of it? Same architect.
Manitowoc?
Oshkosh Lutheran home.
Okay, so there is some place we can go.
It's the same architect as the Dunn County model.
Okay, that might be something you can look at. Thank you.
So let me just get a sense from the room. Are there supervisors who feel that staff should be pursuing option one? Are there supervisors who feel we should be pursuing option two? It sounds like we still have big questions and in a sequence that's pretty important also as we go down the path of option three. What I'm hearing from the group, first and foremost, is the question of how do La Crosse, the residents of La Crosse County who need these services, how do they best get served, and whether or not La Crosse County should be providing those services in some way. So that question of should we be in the business of Lakeview services that we currently provide. What I heard from the group was that was first and foremost. I want to add a question to this discussion that I should know the answer to, and I will embarrass myself in front of everyone by asking it, but when the team worked on this process, did you look at any other physical location? Did you look at other county property? Did you always look at Lakeview, the Lakeview West Salem campus?
We did not look at other property. We didn't really look at location on the Lakeview campus.
Okay.
We felt that was in way future phases.
Okay, well, I hope that that's part of the conversation also, is looking at property that La Crosse County owns and all kinds of options, especially if we're looking at more flexible use of space. So we need to get the answer of should we be in this business, and what I'm hearing you say, Mr. O'Malley, is the time frame is that will feed into the budget process as we progress through that. So I'm seeing heads nodding. That's the general direction that we want to give to staff at this point. Okay.
And it would be our intention to bring back a resolution. So if you think of things between now and when that comes in, it will address most of these items of what would trigger your decision. But at least it says we're not going to devote more time to option one and two, and it will develop a sequence of things that you need as part of your decision-making as we pursue that. So it'll continue to identify that. So if you take the cards with you, if you didn't think of a question, you're driving down the road and you pull over to the side and write down a different question, we want to bring this back through the process so that, again, this is not for decision-making tonight, but we want to make sure that we're going the right path and give you the right information.
And the resolution is to affirm that options one and two are, in fact, dead ends, and that the effort and energy that we pursue from this point forward is answering the questions about what's the scope of business that we need to be in, and pursuing option three
right.
for facility model if we continue to stay in the business.
It'll continue to address the issues that you see on the last four bullet points.
Great.
That would be in August is when we bring that back.
Great. Thank you all very much. Thank you to the planning team for the work that you presented and for everyone sticking with it tonight. It was a very, very full agenda, but I think as we can all agree, very important. Any suggestions for additional future agenda items? We know this is coming back in August. Mm-hmm. If not, the chair would entertain by Supervisor Brockmiller a motion to adjourn, seconded by Supervisor Ferry's discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We are adjourned.